Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
So if you're the type of person who, I don't know, won't use Venmo, doesn't have the latest iPhone, you might be accused of being a Luddite, which was a stupid thing to accuse you of. There are so many more valid things to accuse you of. I know what you've done. That's not really the point of today's show. The point of today's show is that Luddism is a concept that has a history. It has, I think, a revolutionary and, on the balance, kind of honorable history. So we're going to look at that. Who were the Luddites, the original Luddites, and to what degree can their message be carried forward in a meaningful way in a technologically challenging environment? You know, maybe you should be a Luddite, but it's going to take more than not using Venmo. Not that you should use Venmo. All right, we'll be back after the news. So, actually, believe it or not, for 19th century millwork, that might be kind of an ideal scenario where the only thing that it was boring. So, and the term Luddite, you know, really is something that we say to people who don't want to use Venmo or something. I would be one of those people. But I don't consider myself a Luddite. Being a Luddite means something completely different. It meant something very specific in the early 19th century, the Regency era in England. We're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about its obvious through lines to the present moment. We'll even do kind of an alternative history towards the end of the show and talk about what would have happened had the Luddites prevailed. So all of that is ahead. It ties into a lot of other things that we've been thinking and talking about, both on the air and at our meetings and using Slack, which is also something that you as a Luddite should be worried about. Anyway, we'll get to all of that, but it's time to meet our first guest here. We are going to talk to Brian Merchant, the technology columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and the author of Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. So, Brian Merchant, welcome to our show.
Hey, Colin. Thanks for having me.
So I've already said a little bit of it, but you can say it so much better. The history of the Luddites is the early 1800s, and they are not people who are suspicious of the latest pocket watch or some other new technology. They are people dealing with truly unsafe working conditions and exploitive working conditions. But flesh that out for us.
Yeah, no, that's right. So before they became the Luddites, they were cloth workers. They were knitters. They were weavers. They were cloth finishers. So around the turn of the century, the cloth industry in England is sort of the biggest industrial base of workers in the whole country. So it's numerous. There's hundreds of thousands of them, and they have been working in much the same way for hundreds of years, bound to traditions and standards and norms. And many of them quite like these traditions and norms. Many of them get to work either in small shops or at home. The term cottage industry applies to these workers who may have a loom in their house on the second floor. They work as a family. They work from home. They work 30 hours a week. They can take walks in the garden at breaks. They have a lot of autonomy and a lot of dignity, and they quite like this situation. So what they see happening is as the Industrial Revolution, what we now call the Industrial Revolution, starts to gather storm, sort of goaded on by a relatively small cohort of industrialists and people who recognize that, hey, we can start to make more money if we start to divide labor into these sort of systems and buildings that we now know as factories. And if we organize that labor and we use certain machines that are good at sort of expediting the use of that labor, then we can make a lot more money. So the cloth workers see this happening and they protest because it's pretty apparent pretty quickly what is going to happen here. They're going to lose that sort of idyllic, not always glamorous. It's still, filled with challenges, their lifestyle, but they still have that control, and that's going to be moved into the factory where they're going to lose that sort of autonomy over their lives. And meanwhile, they're going to lose their wages too, right? Because one of the things that you can do in the factory is you can start more efficiently producing a lot of stuff and charging less for it. And then the folks in the old system, the domestic system, are going to have to compete with that. So over the first decade of the 1800s, these cloth workers start to organize. It's illegal to organize officially, but they lobby parliament. They say, hey, we're going to need some protections. Machinery and the way it's being used by entrepreneurs is going to cause a lot of suffering if it's allowed to sort of just be rolled out the way that this handful of sort of early tech titan, I call it in the book, has their way. So they lobby for things like a minimum wage. They lobby for some protections against the ways that the machinery can be used. They ask Parliament to uphold the laws on the books that a lot of the entrepreneurs are just kind of steamrolling over in a way that might be familiar to anyone who's watched the way that the Uber saga played out, where Uber went to city after city and said, no, we're a software company. We're not a taxi company, so we don't have to play by the same rules. And that way we can pay our drivers a little bit less and we can charge less for fares. And we see now that that led to all kinds of problems. So eventually, after about 10 years of this large and important base of industrial workers getting ignored time and time again, eventually Parliament just throws out all of the old regulations, and there's very little for them to fall back on. The economy is not particularly diversified, so they really have few options. And in 1811, they finally take up sort of the dramatic sort of uprising that we now know the Luddites for, and they organize in a very particular way, and we can talk about that. And they become the Luddites, and what the Luddites do is they organize to destroy specifically the machines that are allowing sort of factorization, that are automating their work, that are allowing entrepreneurs to staff the machines with child labor instead of skilled labor. And they go in and they break just those machines in a rash of sort of organized rebellion. And then they take their name after an avatar, an apocryphal figure named Ned Ludd, who we can talk about too. But so that's who the Luddites are. They are not dumb. They're not technophobic. In fact, they understand technology really, really well. They use it every day. A lot of them we would call technologists because they're so familiar and so skilled with technology. But they understood exactly the way that technology was being mobilized against them by a relatively small subset, by the elite of the day, and they fought back.
So, yeah, and we should just say that this person, Ned Ludd, is probably a parable, probably kind of a folk tale that in the meets of spirit. Maybe there was a young apprentice named Ned Ludd, but their stories kind of well up around this apprentice who refused to work on a machine, maybe after it had severed the arm of a similarly aged young man or something like that. But it's like the ghost of Tom Joad or the story of John Henry. And it's a lot, Brian, like the story of Robin Hood. There doesn't have to be a real Robin Hood for that to be a story. And that seems to be the same thing with Ned Ludd.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, and so this is taking place, and it's unfolding initially in the exact same region as Robin Hood. So there is this history of sort of dissent, of sort of pushing back against greed and against exploitation. So even if you say them back to back, Ned Ludd, Robin Hood, Ned Ludd, so it starts to seem like, yeah, it was sort of this mythical figure who was made for the purpose. The first time we see him appear is in sort of the recorded history, or the newspaper records is about 1811, right after the Luddites start to show up. So it may very well be that they sort of made him up at the time, or they, as you said, seized onto this legend that had been floating around, and they just sort of made it their own. And as you said, it becomes a very effective tool for sort of early decentralized opposition or decentralized organizing. Just kind of, you can kind of imagine Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter today, where you have this organizing principle, machinery is being used to exploit you. And even if you don't have direct plug into where there was previous Luddite activity, you can sort of assume the avatar of Ned Ludd for your local group or your local band of workers, and you can sort of agitate the same way. And that's what we see happen. It springs up across different regions in England, in the cloth producing regions.
Right. And I think another advantage of having that animating legend is that, or a mythology that goes with it, is that it'll maybe commands a certain, storytelling can be a very powerful thing. So ultimately, you know, the reprisals against the Luddites are very, very strong and ferocious, and maybe partly because of the animating spirit of Ned Ludd, the Luddites develop a pretty strong code of omerta, right? I mean, that's part of the deal, is you want to know who the other Luddites are, you're not getting it out of me. Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so the Luddites, you know, were formed in regionally specific sort of ways, and because again of that mode of organizing, all you do have to do is adopt the name. That the Luddites are often sort of grouped in these very tightly knit sort of cells, I guess you could say, because, you know, that's exactly what it is. It's a group of cloth workers who had been working together their entire lives at a small shop, or they knew everybody around town. A lot of this is in relatively small towns, as well as some of the major industrial centers. But so you knew just about everybody who was part of who would be interested in being part of the Luddites, and you could form these really incredible tight-knit bonds of solidarity. And for those who you didn't know, then yeah, they adopted this system of codes and of secrecy. You had to take an oath, and the oaths were taken very seriously, not only because it soon became a crime punishable by death to take these oaths, because the British crown made it so as a response to these uprisings, but because the people in those cells took it so seriously. So you were really bound by these oaths and bound by your declaration to be part of the Luddite Brotherhood, that they really did take it deadly seriously.
So let's sort of look at how this might translate to the present moment. And I think it's important to say, and you made this point, which is, they didn't smash all machines. They weren't opposed to progress. In fact, some of the types of machines they targeted have been around for quite a while. This is more a way of using technology to subjugate workers that they were bothered by. And so let's fast forward to the present. Yes, we've had Robin Hood. Yes, we've had Ned Ludd. And now another mythic figure comes onto the scene. His name is Andrew Yang. Here he is talking to a nightmare figure named Tucker Carlson. This is A1 Gene.
He says that artificial intelligence and expanded automation could potentially cause violence in this country, and that we need to do something about it right now. Andrew Yang joins us tonight. Andrew, thanks very much for coming on. And I meant that with sincerity. I haven't heard anybody in our political conversation describe the threat as clearly and compellingly as you have. Why should we be worried about automation?
Well, if you look at the backdrop, we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Missouri, and those communities have never recovered. Where if you look at the numbers, half of the workers left the workforce and never worked again, and then half of that group filed for disability. Now, what happened to the manufacturing workers is now going to happen to the truck drivers, retail workers, call centers, fast food workers, and on through the economy as we evolve and technology marginalizes the labor of more and more Americans.
So there is, of course, we all know what happened. Andrew Yang was nominated to be president by both major political parties. He's our president now, and we are safe. No, that's the alternative histories in the third segment. I'm sorry. No, in a way, this was just, I mean, it was very interesting to a lot of people, and Andrew Yang really did mobilize people. He is sending a similar message, right? I mean, he's not the only one doing this, but we're in a second machine age that has a whole bunch of new kind of paradigm-shattering challenges, and we don't seem to be taking it very seriously. Maybe you can expand on that.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of sort of problematic elements about Andrew Yang's political program. And in fact, he's kind of abandoned a lot of this talk. But he does raise some valid points. And he was talking about this compellingly in a way that few others at the time were sort of talking about so loudly. And one interesting side note that I'll make before I dive into answering your question directly is that one of his policy proposals is that we do something like a value-added tax that's kind of specifically tailored towards people that are doing automating, where you tax basically the automation or the extra productivity of automation, and you use that and kind of funnel it back, in his case, to pay for a universal basic income where you give everybody money or something like that. But the Luddites, 200 years ago, before they organized as the Luddites, you had proto-Luddite folks in Parliament saying, what if we did this? What if we took the automated sort of machinery and we taxed the extra cloth it produced and used that to pay for retraining programs or things that could, you know, give us a little buffer? So they're really on the same page in terms of what we've been thinking about these things in much the same way, in much the same formation for 200 years. And Andrew Yang, you know, he really, I think maybe he's gets a little into the dramatics of it. He has these scenarios where truck drivers are going to be blockading the highways after they lose their jobs to automated trucks. And it's not clear a lot of that is happening right now. But I think he's really one of the few talking about like Luddite sensibilities. He's really one of the few raising the alarm bells in that fashion. And again, there's a lot of nuance to pick apart what we should be concerned about and what we shouldn't be concerned about. But he is right that a lot of big companies right now are hoping to automate jobs. You know, it's not clear they can automate at the scale he's hoping they'll be able to, but they're going to be doing things like using automation, using AI to get leverage over workers to do things like they did back in the Luddites' day, like push down wages.
Right. And, you know, it does seem to me that if you don't talk about this directly and concretely and spell out what's the problem, what isn't the problem, you leave a lot of unfocused anxiety and rage on the table. I mean, not insignificantly, and I mean, I experienced this directly talking to them, a lot of pretty fervent Trump supporters, the kind of people who would show up at rallies, their second choice was Bernie Sanders, who doesn't have, you know, a political profile, anything like Trump. But there was this sense of some kind of age is ending. We are going to be left out, and no one cares about that. And it seems to me if you don't have something as specific and as intelligent and as focused as 19th century Luddism, what's left is just sort of unfocused rage against the machine.
That's exactly right. And that's, I think you can explain a good deal of that sort of anger and disaffection, you know, some of it from this. There's an interesting study from, I think, Brookings Institute, where they looked at the regions where automation had taken root most deeply, and they found that where there was more automation, there was more support for Trump. And you know, it's a little neat, and you can't really necessarily distill direct correlation from that. But I think it's an interesting thing to think about where these jobs were uprooted and left with nothing really coming to replace those jobs, you do sort of get this this disaffection, this more diffuse anger. And today it is sort of being spread around, but I will say it is starting to be more concentrated in the directions where it should be. We are seeing more animosity towards big tech, less interest in granting them leeway when they make sort of sweeping decisions about using this or that kind of AI or automation. So I think our focus has been sort of pointed in the right direction generally, and you know, we're helped out by groups like the WGA and SAG, who have really sort of identified AI and the use of technology as something that studios and bosses are hoping to use against them. And in many cases, quite correctly so, artists and illustrators, they're organizing against the use of generative AI in newsrooms with very real grievances. You talk to writers, copywriters, you talk to artists and illustrators. And this year, you'll hear the same story a lot. They've seen less work. They're getting less work because folks are using generative AI instead of turning to them. And that's leading to a whole new sort of frontier, a whole new sort of, I guess, battle lines being drawn, you could call it.
Right. I mean, the battle lines are all over the place. And we're going to talk very specifically about the writer strike and the actor strike and AI in the next segment. But it also, not to be too cute about this, but one of the apparatuses that the Luddites were not in favor of was something called a gig loom. And ironically, the gig economy now, which has nothing to do with the gig loom, is one of the places where all this is happening. There's a price to whatever convenience and economies are afforded to you by Uber and Lyft and stuff like that. There's just ways in which a lot of the stuff that we use is produced by so-called contract labor to whom employers have no responsibility. But I want to also, just as we kind of wind up here, just talk about the unfashionability, the stigma of adopting any kind of anti-tech position. You know, I mean, you really do get accused of being the old man yelling at trains, right, if in fact you question any of this stuff and whether you have to do it. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that gets processed, and maybe even if there's sort of a way to talk back to it?
Yeah, 100%. And I the first step is knowing that from the get-go, this was a very direct and purposeful campaign. You could even call it a propaganda effort, almost, because as soon as the Luddites crop up, you see this sort of language that from, especially coming from elites, coming from the crown at the time, the state, and the industrialists, they really go to pains to paint the Luddites as deluded, as misguided wretches who know not what they do, kind of thing, where they're smashing the machine because they don't understand that it's the future. And this is the portrait that they're selling to the public, or trying to, because I wanted to say this earlier, because they are hugely popular at first. They are like Robin Hood. They are, people will come out into the streets and cheer them as they are smashing machines. They have won public opinion in the beginning of their uprising. And because of all the things that the state then does, not least of this sort of propaganda campaign, you have the prince putting out proclamations that's painting them as deluded. As soon as the Luddites go to trial, the prosecutors are entering into the record, just that's pretty much their case against the Luddite, that these guys are misguided wretches following some, being, they've been brainwashed by someone with dark motivations. And this is all really purposeful. The Theodore Roszak, the cultural critic from in the 90s, had a really great line, and he said, if the Luddites didn't exist, then these folks, the industrialists and the elites, would have to invent them, because you need kind of a boogeyman to paint as the oppositional force, someone to blame, a straw man for having any sort of criticism of the technologies you're hoping to kind of pass through, barrel through, and profit mightily from. To this day, you know, Google and Facebook and Apple, they all present us with the products and they ram them through. They have concentrated such a mass and amassed such power that they don't really feel like they have to answer to anyone. It has become a pretty profoundly undemocratic process. And in part, they have done so by painting this sort of mythology where if you do protest any slice of this, that extends to disliking surveillance, disliking your job being automated away, then yes, you get to be the recipient of the term Luddite or the equivalent, somebody who's backwards looking, somebody who doesn't get it, because it profits the elites mightily to have this sort of assumption baked into the firmament of our economy and our culture. And it's, you know, one that we really do need to challenge. And we do have to say, you know, Thomas Pynchon was right. It is okay to be a Luddite. It is okay to especially single out the parts that are pernicious to society or hurtful to commonality, as the Luddites would have put it in the day, and say no. Say no to things. And we are beginning to see that. We're seeing municipalities ban facial recognition. Again, I mentioned the writers and the artists. We're seeing them say no to generative AI. We're seeing Luddism kind of emerge as a viable strategy for dealing with some of this stuff. And we will be the better for it, because technological development is something we've long accepted as something that is done to us, often by very big companies. We do not need to accept it. It is not determined that that should be the way that we decide who benefits from technology. And we have a real opportunity here to change that thinking. And I hope the Luddites can help us do it.
All right. Brian Merchant, the book is Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. This deals with what we've been talking about today, Luddism. Brian Merchant, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. We're going to focus in on that whole question of generative AI and its role in the creation of culture.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Dirty computer.
So we've gone from gig looms to computers, dirty or otherwise. That's where a lot of the battles will be fought, have been fought already. To talk a little bit more about this and about the nature of work, Gavin Mueller is an assistant professor of new media and digital culture at the University of Amsterdam and the author of Breaking Things at Work, The Luddites Are Right About Why You Hate Your Job. Gavin Mueller, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I mean, let's just build right on what Brian Merchant talked about a couple of times in the entertainment industry, the writers and the actors. In each case, a sticking point in the contract with the studios has been the use of generative AI. And the one involving the actors is really creepy because it does appear that it's possible simply to scan one image of an actor and essentially, quote, employ, unquote, that actor going forward just by rendering them and putting them into scenes and just adding them, photoshopping or movie shopping them in. With the actors, the question is, with the writers, the question is, you know, can AI be allowed to generate scripts that are used by the holders of these contracts. So what do you see there, and how do you link it constructively to Luddism?
Yeah, well, I mean, we have a very clear case or cases where it seems that technology will be used to replace or otherwise augment work. And I think the other thing that we see is that that the writers and the actors are very perceptive in understanding that these technologies are a direct threat to the way that things are being done, and that they immediately highlighted the use of AI as a problem. In fact, they've been scanning actors for a few years now, which was not something that a lot of people were paying much attention to, but now has become sort of front and center on the agenda. And so to me, this is, you know, really right out of the Luddite playbook, right? To dramatically show the technology here is being used as a weapon to undermine working conditions. And I think the other thing that we want to be really conscious of, and something that was also true of the original Luddite movement that Brian so ably encapsulated for us, is the Luddites were also concerned about the overall quality of what was coming out of their industry. They were skilled technicians, as Brian said. They were proud of their work. And the goods that were coming out of these textile factories were incredibly inferior in quality to what the weavers had been producing. And so one argument that the workers who eventually would become Luddites said was like, you're ruining our reputation as an industry. We're going to, people respected what we produced, and now they're going to associate us with this cheap mass produced stuff. And I think we have a real big issue, a very, very similar issue here. I'm a university professor, so I'm sort of on the front lines of ChatGPT when it comes to grading papers. And I can tell you the quality is really not there. It's very polished, it's grammatically correct, and it's completely dead. It's very empty. And I think this is another kind of risk that we'll run, that something that will increase, you know, a stock price of a media company or earn a CEO a bonus is going to come at the expense not only of the pay and working conditions of creative workers, but it will also come at the expense of the quality of our entertainment, things that we love, right? The shows that we love, the films that we're passionate about. It's very possible that they'll degrade in quality with the use of these tools, which are quite hyped, as Brian mentioned, you know, the inevitable future. But I think when you actually see what they can do are, you know, not actually, you know, don't exactly feel like they're ushering in some sort of cybernetic utopia. They fall far short of what I would call real talent.
Right. And I think the point that you're making, too, about the output is a really important one for everybody. And it was true for the Luddites, too, that if you got a bad blanket or a bad sweater or something like that, and you're colder than you otherwise would be. Here, particularly when we're talking about content creators, you have, as you say, a kind of deanimated culture being pumped out and probably being devoured pretty enthusiastically. It could be argued that a lot of our popular culture has been deanimated for some time under other pretexts. But that's sort of bad for us. It's bad in a very long-term way if we lose track of elements of humanism and human creativity and culture.
It's really quite funny because for a long time, the argument made for introducing automation into labor processes was that, well, you know, work isn't that great anyway. These machines will they'll alleviate a lot of the drudgery and a lot of the burdens, and therefore you'll have the time to do the more interesting things with your life. We've been promised, in fact, predicted that machines would do so much of our work that we would have 15-hour work weeks. This was something that the economist John Maynard Keynes was saying, almost 100 years ago. And it hasn't happened. And now we're at the point where the promise is not that the machines will relieve drudgery, that the machines will actually start taking away the very things that people want to do with their free time, which is create, to tell stories, to make art, the things that so many people feel passionate about and that so many people wish that they had more time to dedicate their lives to. It's quite a darkly ironic scenario that we're being presented here. So I think this is also something that we really need to recognize. I think you're right. The technology is not maybe the only force that drives our entertainment into sort of less elevating kind of places. There are other pressures as well, but certainly it's a quite a stark sort of vision that we're being presented with, that the things that we love will not even be made by people, and that in fact it will be impossible for anyone to dedicate their lives to doing this, to coming up with wonderful ideas, great stories, sort of brain-melting artwork, even video games, right? That'll all be done by machines. I think this is really interesting to me because it's actually a betrayal of what historically has been a lot of the rhetoric that celebrates automation.
I think another part of this, there's so much to talk about, but I know that you are something of a student and an observer of Frederick Taylor, who early in the 20th century was trying to turn workers into more like soldiers, and soldiers who just knew their one job and took their orders and didn't think about the entirety of any kind of system, just obedient cogs in a larger machine. And I think one thing you can look at today from a sort of Luddist perspective is the next step, which is turning workers into almost transhumans, to more like machines. I mean, an Amazon warehouse worker is kind of monitored and beeped in and scanned in and out and is more than just a soldier at this point, but in a way, slowly being turned in to a machine that's monitorable and controllable in the way that Taylor might have dreamed of as he fell asleep some night.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because one of the slogans of the Amazon workers movement is "We're not robots." They are so tightly controlled and constrained by the technologies that they work with that set the pace, that monitor all their movements and feed them back into the system, and that isolate them from one another. I think Taylor would be overjoyed. It's really the realization of so much of what he wanted to accomplish and failed to accomplish in the factories of his day. His main insight was if workers have a comprehensive knowledge of the production process and an ability to control it, then they will have autonomy over the production process. They will set the pace. They will say whether they're going to work or whether they're not, and how work will be done. So the first step in asserting managerial authority over workers would be to isolate them and, just as you described, set them on one task. They only know how one thing is done. The other thing was to survey how everything is done and collect as much what we call data today, so that you have a completely comprehensive understanding of the entire process, but that understanding is only held by managers and owners. It's kept away from the workers. And the purpose of that is once you have control over that process, once you isolate workers from themselves, then you can accelerate the pace of production. And you have undermined the forms of solidarity and struggle that workers up till now had been using. So yeah, Amazon is like Taylor's dream. Workers don't even get break rooms in some of these facilities. So when they do have time off, they end up sitting in their cars by themselves. They're not talking about their work. They're not talking about what the next step is.
And if they're on the road, they're peeing in plastic bottles. So just in order to meet all the clock stuff. So last question, really. I could talk to you a lot longer, but we're running out of time here. And I think the question is, what do we break? I mean, in some ways, being a Luddite now might, for example, Lily Tyson, the senior producer whom you've been talking with, and I share a distrust of Venmo, and we have this kind of Bartleby, like, you know, I would prefer not to Venmo. I'm not going to do that. But that doesn't really strike me as a transformative attitude, and it's less clear what we need to break, and just, I mean, metaphorically break, if we're going to break anything. Is it maybe the distribution choke points, you know, particularly for things like culture? I mean, do we need to break Warner and Max and that whole big conglomerate? What's a response that would mean anything in a Luddist way?
I mean, you can look at Luddism happening at various scales. I think refusal is actually a great place to start, to just say no, to tell other people you're saying no, to say it's okay to say no. I think Brian said almost the exact same thing, right? It's okay to say no. I think when it comes to the workplace, you say, all right, you know, what technology do we not like, and how is it, what leverage do we have? You might, depending on the level of organization, have the ability to collectively say, we're not going to work in this particular way. We're not going to have these types of working conditions or these pay levels. And then we can also think about at an even larger scale, well, let's talk about, you know, reforms, right? It seems like kind of beyond the pale, like, wow, what could we actually ask the government to step in and make some rules about this? But actually, Frederick Taylor, that's actually how he was defeated. He was unsuccessful at implementing his procedures in the factories that he was operating in. He picked a bad fight, the Watertown Arsenal in Massachusetts, so not too far from a lot of your listeners. And they not only refused to do what he asked, refused to be monitored, refused to operate by his principles, but they also contacted a congressional representative. Taylor had to give testimony in front of the government. He was not a very sympathetic individual, and he didn't do a very good job of making his case. And the government said, you know what? The factory workers are right. They don't have to work this way. The guy you fired for not agreeing to be timed, you have to reinstate him. And Taylor, you're out. And Taylor was so devastated. He had a nervous breakdown, died a few years later, and spent his remaining time on Earth trying to invent new types of golf clubs.
Are you listening, Jeff Bezos? Actually, he probably is listening. We have to stop there, but I think that's a great place to stop. And I'll just check, too. Alexa, is it okay if I stop using technology? And she says no. Gavin Mueller is the assistant professor of new media and digital culture at the University of Amsterdam, author of Breaking Things at Work. The Luddites are right about why you hate your job. Let's take a break. We'll come back after this.
Colin McEnroe Show on Facebook or Twitter at Colin McShow. Make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to or following our podcast on any podcast app. It's free. You don't have to wait an hour after eating before you go swimming. That's just something our mothers believe. Back to the show.
And we're back. Our technical producer today is Jedi Master Eugene Amatruda. He cannot be replaced by technology. He knows more than the tech does. Lily Tyson is our senior producer. And here in our final segment, Miriam A. Cherry is going to join us, a professor of law at St. John's University in New York City, faculty director of the Labor and Employment Law Center. She's the author of Work in the Digital Age, a course book on labor technology and regulation. And very much for our purposes, also the author of The Future Encyclopedia of Luddism. We'll explain about that right now. Miriam Cherry, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what you did was construct a counterfactual history, one in which the Luddites prevail. So first of all, explain why you did that.
So I was actually writing as part of a larger book, a project. The book was called Economic Science Fictions. And we were asked to really be creative and think about things like alternate history. And that's really what I wanted to do with this piece. So I write a lot about the work as it is right now, some of the issues legally that workers face. So earlier we talked about the gig economy, and I do a lot of work on that. But I also am interested in the future, and you can't really understand the future of work unless you understand where we started with the Luddites. And so, this was of great interest to me.
So the idea is that they prevail, they are successful. And so their movement turns into at least part of public discourse, one that, as you say, promotes smart growth and democratic technology policies. So what would that look like now? Let's imagine that here in 2023, we are now the heirs to this process, which incorporates a lot of the thinking of the Luddites. What does the world look like? How is it different?
Yeah, so I really took as the jumping off point for this story. There's other authors that write a great deal of alternate history. And in France, they call this uchronie, mm-hmm. the idea that you take that pivotal moment in history and then look at what would have happened if it came out differently. And so in the story, I really wanted to explore what that would look like for modern day. And, you know, just starting with a number of things that would happen differently, because there would be some kind of prioritization. If we're really talking about democratic processes around technology, then we wouldn't have the techno-determinism that your previous guest talked about, the idea that technology is just something that's done to us. But rather, it would be a humanistic vision, I think, where it would be groups of workers that would talk about which processes do they want to automate, which processes are dangerous, which processes do they need help with, or they're boring, right? Things that it would make everyone's working life better if they were automated.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it leads to more critical reflection and evaluation of what we're building. What's it going to do to us to build it? How are we going to build in freedom and maybe breaks from technology, things like that? I thought it was also interesting. Oh, we're going to run out of time so fast here. I apologize. But one of the things I liked about your construction was, in this case, Ned Ludd is a real person. And he also has, if he's the kind of Jesus of the movement, he has a Paul the Apostle, right? He has this Lieutenant Mellor, who's maybe the person. And you always need a visionary and then the person who can kind of translate it into an action plan. And I thought that was a really interesting choice that you made.
Well, a lot of the story was actually based on real events. So certainly when earlier guests were talking, I just found myself nodding along. I mean, where I started sort of inventing or engaging in some storytelling was in trying to create Ludd as an actual person, and then also the right hand man, so to speak, who was definitely helping. And I would have liked to tell more of the stories of the rank and file as well, because Luddites were an overrepresentation of women and children versus what you would expect maybe in the labor movement if we look at it today. So very interesting set of folks for sure.
Yeah, and does Ned has a daughter, right, who keeps it going on after that? Or is it
Mellor? That's right. That's right. So in the story, I just needed a way to kind of figure out a connection back to the initial events with the Luddites. And some of that was to have more sort of the female characters, in this case, they were in my invention, but just to sort of keep this going over a period of time so that And then to think about it as a worldwide movement also, not just centered on industrializing England. The Luddites are, you know, in some ways just this very particular moment in time. And to sort of generalize that, and then to have some things that would be traditions that people would use, like eating a meal of fish and chips, to kind of take you back to maybe the origins of where the movement came from.
Yeah, and so this is a movement, this becomes a movement that puts people over property. There's something kind of familiarly radical and revolutionary about that idea, right? That the people should have the power, and decisions should be made about people as opposed to maximizing profit or stock worth or anything else.
Yeah. And I mean, and that doesn't mean necessarily sacrificing progress. I think it's more of a directed prioritization is sort of what I had them engage in the story. The idea would be that there's a lot of discussion of what things are most important. And it's not that innovation is stifled or that people don't care about technology. They do. It's just more that there's a decision about what those goals are, rather than having the opposite, which is, there is no prioritization. Technology is what it is. And then everyone has to accept it, because if you don't, you will get left behind, or have those negative stories that we talked about before that were told to discredit the Luddites. And again, using the word Luddite as kind of a negative term of someone who doesn't like technology or is against progress.
There's a little bit also, we have to stop here, but there's a little bit also of that kind of that seven generation idea that we inherit, or we should inherit and adopt from indigenous peoples. Just think about the implications of whatever change you're making over seven generations, which is ordinarily not how we think. Thank you, Miriam A. Cherry, author of Work in the Digital Age, a course book on labor technology and regulation. And in the MIT Technology Review, check out her Future of Encyclopedia of Luddism.